Okay, well, I was intending to do a follow-up of last week's study. Even as we felt like we went through all kinds of details, there's always more. And then when I went back to it, I ended up kind of taking a rabbit trail off of the study, but still connected to it. So this will be Sukkot number 2 and rabbit trail. So let's pray. Lord, thank you for your Shabbat this morning. Pray you give us your peace and your rest. And thank you for redeeming us, for changing us, and always giving us a new start, a new year, and times in the year that we can look back over our life and change things and grow. Pray you'd be with us in this study and help us learn something of you. Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Okay, so for the overcap of last week, I guess 75% of you were here. But we talked about Sukkot being the holiday in the Bible. And we looked at all the passages describing Sukkot and how there are many details left out. And its very nature and its very name keep changing based on where you read, whether it's just an agricultural holiday or whether it has greater significance, what you actually do. We have to rejoice, but how do you rejoice? And why do you take these 4 things? So we talked about all of that, and we got into a lot of the details. I was reading one commentary this week, which was interesting, who, you know, he's a scholar, not approaching it from, let's just say he's a very open scholar. And he was saying that Sukkot basically got its relevance, its historical relevance during the exile. That originally it was more agricultural, and then the exile, people looked back and started defining themselves and seeing what God had done in history, and then relating that to the holiday of Sukkot. And of course, we talked about some of the parallels in the ancient Near East with New Year's and rain at this time of year, and a harvest and gathering. Anyway, his theory was that since the exile, Pesach basically came to dominate as the holiday over against Sukkot, because Sukkot was more regionally accepted as a holiday. And so kind of to separate it from that whole only a harvest festival, which is in itself a good thing to thank God for the harvest, Judaism tended to focus on Passover as the redemptive holiday that trumps all holidays. Of course, we talked about Passover, Shavuot, and Sukkot being the 3 pilgrimage holidays. So they're all still 3 big holidays. It's just what you feel through the calendrical year, what you feel is the biggest, most emphasized holiday. And we were talking about how in the Bible times it was Sukkot, and nowadays, and maybe you could argue it still is Sukkot, some people would argue it's more Pesach. And this is all fascinating because I think where we'll end up this morning will again be this interplay between Pesach and Sukkot. As being the holiday that's most representative of God's redemption, because they both come to be associated with God's redemption. And that also ties into the whole calendar, which we talked a little bit about last week as well, how there are 2 calendars represented in the Bible, and one has its first month of the year in the springtime, in Nisan, and it's numbered number 1. And yet New Year's, which actually isn't named in the Bible as New Year's, but celebrated as such, and Yom Kippur and Sukkot, they all happen in the 7th month, which is actually the celebrated New Year's in the ancient Near East as well, the 7th month. And our calendar, all the names today, the Jewish calendar is also comes from the time that they spent in exile in Babylon, where they used that calendar. And you have a lot of Second Temple literature against, there's a fight over calendar, which calendar is the best. Because if you go with lunar or solar calendar, it's going to be different. When does Sabbath fall? Which day is the holy day? And so, depending which calendar you're using, you're going to have a different Shabbat. And so this becomes a big issue. Anyway, however it fell, today we have the calendar we have.
What was the alternate Shabbat? I mean, how does that figure with...
Well, we should have Jo in here, but she's our astrophysicist member. But basically, if you have a calendar, there were certain proponents of a 364-day calendar, because then you can divide it perfectly in weeks of seven, and so then you have a Shabbat that's just always on the same day. Problem is, it doesn't really line up with the sun, so eventually your year starts to shift and your seasons will be out of whack. Then if you have a purely lunar calendar, like the Muslims have, like Ramadan, it shifts every year. And so again, you won't have a calendar in keeping with the seasons. So to have a lunar calendar but still keep it in with the seasons, you have to make a lunar solar calendar, kind of make some adjustments. And so the Jewish calendar we have adds a month, an extra month, every so often. Is it every 17 years? Within 17 years you add, they're all odd numbers, so they're hard to remember. Something like,
is it three?
More than three, maybe seven?
Seven? Yes, the
months.
Principle, yeah.
No, I don't know. I can check the detail again. But you have to compensate with extra months to keep it in line with the seasons.
And a leap year every 4 years, right?
Yeah, even in our Gregorian calendar, we have leap years. Little minor adjustments, because we can never get 365.25 or 4 or whatever the point is there. It's always going to shift a little bit.
Well, does Shabbat ever on a different day? Of course, anyway.
No, I mean, it depends how you're numbering it. But if your calendar
is always, seventh
it's always
day.
On the seventh day. Oh, but depending on your calendar, that seventh day might be a different day, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, have the Jewish people kept track all this time? All these years?
Well, kept track one way or another.
Yeah, so they go by...
The point being that since exile, they've used the Babylonian system, which is a lunar solar calendar.
Right.
So it's based on the moons, but then it's compensated for...
Well, what did they set up before that, then?
We don't know exactly. We just have remnants in the Bible of the older names.
You mean humankind? Or
when anybody reads in the Bible, there's four different references.
I mean, do
of
they know?
Old month names.
Yeah.
We have the Gezer calendar from the 10th century BC, and that, oh, here's Joe, and that starts the year in Asif, which is the harvest month. There's Joe, we're just talking about solar and lunar calendars.
Yeah, talking about the months of the year, because I know
that's
all.
Right. That's right. But actually, it's of such a technical nature, I'm worried if we get too much into there, we could do a whole several studies just on the calendar. And it's very fascinating, because there is a huge debate going on in the Jewish world in the Second Temple times.
Maybe she can tell us about how often do they add the extra month of Av in the...
You mean the extra
Adav?
I think it's every 3 years or something, I think, something like that. I don't remember.
So, okay. So, I'm just recapping what we did last week. So, we talked about this tension between the first and the seventh month, which really begins the new year. And we will read a little bit from Rosh Hashanah today, because it's fascinating and it will lead us to our good rabbit trail. We also mentioned last week about this Sukkot being connected to rain and how there's different judgments in the world. I can read that little reference from Mishnah Rosh Hashanah 1, chapter 1, verse 2. Which I'm actually reading from a Talmud, which is a commentary on the Mishnah. So I don't know how fast I'll be able to find it. It's like 16a maybe. And it says, at four seasons, divine judgment is passed on the world. At Passover in respect of produce, at Pentecost in respect of fruit, at New Year all creatures pass before him, like children of Maron, which no one really knows what that means, but apparently one by one. As it says, he that fashioneth the heart of them all, that considereth all their doings. And on tabernacles, judgment is passed in respect of rain. So you have this link of Sukkot and rain. And you say, well, that's great, it's in the Talmud and Mishnah, but is it in the Bible? And yes, it is. So let's just peek at Zechariah 14:16.
One more time, the reference.
Zechariah 14:16. One of the 12 little ones. He's got some nice apocalyptic pictures to paint for us. We're talking about a future war here that is future to the time when Zechariah is speaking anyway. And all these crazy things that will happen. And who would like to read, starting from verse 16 to the end of the chapter? Or at least two verses. Zechariah 14, sorry, no, 14, verse 16. Chapter 14, verse 16.
Then the survivors from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. If any of the peoples of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, they will have no rain. If the Egyptian people do not go up and take part, they will have no rain. The Lord will bring on them the plague he inflicts on the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. On that holy day to the Lord will be inscribed on the bells of the horses, and the cooking pots in the Lord's house will be like the sacred bowls in the front of the altar. Every pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be holy to the Lord Almighty, and all who come to sacrifice will take some of the pots and cook in them. And on that day, there will be no longer a Canaanite in the house of the Lord Almighty.
Which is interesting, because Kana'ani, in other references, can also be a merchant.
Right.
Hey, Gary, you should write that down for Brian. Kana'ani. It's ambiguous. Schultz, he wanted things that were ambiguous, whether it's a merchant or a Canaanite, literally Canaanite. That's interesting. We have, you know, Jesus kicking out the merchants in the temple. Okay, so anyway, we have this apocalyptic picture, and within it, all these nations are going to come to Jerusalem. Some senses, there are nations today already doing this. Kind of a apocalypse now.
I have a question. Turning to I've never been to the Feast of Tabernacles yet. Not that I would like to go check it out at some point.
You missed your chance.
I missed my chance. Do they sell pots there?
Do they sell pots?
Yeah.
That I'm not sure of. They sell many things.
Okay.
But mainly
because that would
about
mean,
the land. I don't
that would
know
be interesting.
Pots.
They're supposed to take those pots
that
back
would
and
be,
cook with
it would
them.
Be interesting. Tell Stefan to make some ancient pots and sell them.
You could make a lot of money.
I think he does have a stand there, actually, but I don't know what kind of pots he sells. But so you saw that connection to the rain. If you don't celebrate Sukkot, you won't have rain. That's our hint that these two have already been connected in the time of Zechariah and presumably before that, because he's not even bothering to explain it. He's just stating it as a fact. And this also fascinates me when I think of Jesus' statement. What does he say about the rain?
Falls on the righteous and the unrighteous.
Yeah, it falls on the righteous and the unrighteous. And there's this whole little debate here in the Mishnah about, you know, if you're righteous, and right here, and actually in Zechariah, if you're righteous, you're going to get rain. If you're not, you're not going to get rain. And it's an interesting conversation that Jesus is having with the nature of the world. Like, that principle can be true. You know, it kind of goes back to our Deuteronomy concept of if you do good, you'll prosper. If you don't do good, you know, you'll be stricken with this and that. And yet we see good people not prospering and bad people prospering.
They're kind of put Jesus in the camp of Kohelet.
Yeah, kind of. For those who are here, there's a sermon from last week on Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, and also connected to Sukkot. And we're going to touch on that theme as well, because it was mentioned, Gary mentioned in that sermon, that your day of death should be more important than your day of birth, because that's when you're celebrating the life that you've actually lived and not just your potential of being born. And we're going to be considering that some today. Okay. I also wanted to go back. Last week, we didn't get a chance to actually read all the context in the Bible where Sukkah is mentioned. And I thought that was nice to give us a feel. Because, guess where Sukkah, the word Sukkah, is never mentioned? That's a hard question. Where? In the wandering stories. The desert wilderness stories. There is never a mention of Sukkah. And yet, what do we read in Leviticus? We read, because I made them dwell in Sukkot. Right? And so then we had talked about last week about how the rabbis debated, what does Sukkot mean? Does it mean literally a temporary dwelling? Or does it mean the cloud of glory? And when you just approach the debate without any background, that just seems like far-fetched. What do you mean, the cloud of glory? But I think if we read some of the context of the word Sukkah, we start to think about it. So there's several stories that use Sukkah as just its basic meaning of some kind of temporary shelter. And then we have some poetry that uses it as more of this divine shelter or kind of metaphor. So let's just flip through. How many here have an English Bible? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, if you don't mind, I'll give a bunch of you a reference that you can look up, and then we'll go through and read them together. So, maybe, what's your name?
Nancy.
Nancy, if you could take Jonah 4, 5. If you have the book of Jonah, all those who study
Jonah
Hebrew with us.
After,
and while you're looking for it, Jonah's in Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. He's in the book as well. Okay, while you're looking for Jonah 4, 5, if Karen, you could look for 1 Kings 20,
Obadiah can,
12 and 16.
I
mean, that whole chunk there will be.
Chunk.
And then, what's your name?
Lucy.
Lucy, if you could look for Genesis 33:17. And then,
John,
that's right. John, if you could look for Amos 9:11. We touched on Isaiah 1:8, that metaphor. Maybe we can read it again anyway. Sheila, if you could look for, I'll give you 2 Samuel 22:12. It's more, that's the poem. You can either do 2 Samuel 22:12 or Psalm 18:12. They're identical poems. One is recorded in the book of Samuel, one is recorded in the book of Psalm. Either way, it's verse 12. And then, what's your name?
Lindsay.
Lindsay. If you could look at Isaiah 1:8. We'll just read that again. And
hi, I'm from Singapore.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you.
Do you read the English Bible or yes? Would you look at Isaiah 4:6?
Okay, sure.
That will be our first round. Then we have four more references, mostly from Job and Psalms. Does everyone find their place?
Tell me again.
Jonah, we'll start with Jonah 4, 5.
So Jonah went out of the city and sat on the east side of the city.
There he made himself a shelter and sat under it in the shade till he might see what would become of the city.
Okay, so you all remember the story of Jonah. He's delivered his prophecy. He's going to wait for 40 days to see God smite them, which, of course, he gets frustrated that doesn't happen. And God even causes a vine to grow up and cover his sukkah, you know, just like a proper sukkah. So that's a practical... He needs a sukkah because he's out in the middle of a desert and he needs covering from the sun. And when that vine dies, what happens? He faints, or he gets sunstroke, basically, and he wants to die.
You could also read something mystical into it, though, as well.
Yeah, you could, actually.
It's just what the book is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so, Karen, you have 1 Kings 20, 12, and 16.
This was interesting because I looked it up in here in our little NIV, and it said Ben-Hadad heard this message while he and the kings were drinking in their tents.
In their tents.
And
yeah.
I suppose in Exodus, does it also use the word Ohale Yaakov, like tents? More
it does. Well, it uses Mahane as
Mahane
the camp.
Mahane as a camp, right.
Yeah, and it always refers to the people went back to their tents. Ohel.
Ohel,
right.
Like Ohale.
But never the word Sukkah.
Yeah, Sukkah, yeah.
Yeah.
But then in this one, it's a stone Tanakh. It says, it happened when Ben-Hadad heard this reply, he was drinking, he and the other kings in huts.
In huts.
So I suppose that's, then it's probably Sukkot here.
Both are Sukkot.
But then it says huts. He said to his servants, set up, and they set up for the attack against the city. In 16. They went forth from the city at noontime while Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk, he and the 32 kings who helped him in their huts.
In their huts. So you have a military campaign, and the people, the leaders are sitting around in their sukkot. So some kind of temporary, whether you want to say a hut or a tent. It's hard to say. We mentioned last week, there is no rules, there's no description what a sukkah looks like or how to construct a sukkah. So we really don't know. You know, is it?
But they're using that word each time.
Yeah.
In all these.
Right. All these references, we're following the word sukkah. Okay, so some form of shelter that's temporary. They're not going to stay there forever. They're there to wage war. All right, so Genesis 33:17.
And Jacob journeyed to Sukkot and built him a house and made booths for his cattle. Therefore the name of the place is called Sukkot.
Okay, we also have a city in the Bible named Sukkot, and here we have an explanation of the city name. Because when Jacob was there, he built these sukkot, temporary dwellings, for his animals, or while he's looking after his animals. So presumably if you're a shepherd and you're going far away from where your actual house is, you build yourself something to stay with the livestock. Okay, Amos 9:11.
On that day, I will raise up the tabernacle of David, which is fallen down, and repair its damages. I will raise up its ruins and rebuild it as in the days of old.
So this is curious. Now it's being used as a metaphor of David, David's dynasty. And instead of saying Beit David, which we're used to, the house of David, what's he calling it?
Sukkot David.
Sukkah. Very interesting.
And why not Mishkan David?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot you could think about that image of a sukkah. It's temporary, and yet he's rebuilding it. So there's something permanent about it as well. And maybe that interplay Gary was mentioning, how you could also see it as mystical, where it's God's presence and dwelling.
I don't know if I caught exactly what you're saying, but maybe it has to do with the humility of it as well.
Yeah.
He didn't want some huge cathedral. He wanted a sukkah, even
right.
if it was permanent. Is that what you really meant?
Yeah.
that's what I
remember.
That seems to be what's in contrast to the regular phrase of the house of David. What do you remember?
I remember Claire giving a study or message on it, or it involved it, that the Sukkot David, the her understanding of Amos's idea here is the fact that when the ark was brought in, but they weren't able to, there wasn't a temple built yet, and so it wasn't also where the Mishkan was, because it was elsewhere, but it was in Jerusalem, that here you didn't actually have the same kind of division between priests and people, and access to the ark was actually crazy for about half of his lifetime until Solomon, you know, built the temple. Mm-hmm. And when it's mentioned in Acts 15, it's a nice picture because it's a place where you don't have a barrier between the Gentiles either, etc. It's sort of a...
Yeah.
But it is ironic that it's a temporary place. That's very ironic.
So it's whenever it was sat outside waiting for the temple or whatever.
Yeah, and it wasn't... It was approachable in a sense.
Right. Well, and you have those two pictures already concerning the tabernacle in the wilderness. You have one in the center of the camp,
right,
where the Levites live around it. You have another one, a meeting tent, where you just go there. Anyone can go there and meet with God. It's more Pentecostal.
Right.
God comes down and meets with you. Okay. So that's kind of a metaphor there of a sukkah. And then 2 Samuel 22:12. You can read, actually start reading from verse 7. And go 12 to 12.
Through 12.
Yeah.
In my distress I called to the Lord. I called out to my God. From his temple he heard my voice. My cry came to his ears. The earth trembled and quaked. The foundations of the heavens shook. They trembled because he was angry. Smoke rose from his nostrils. Consuming fire came from his mouth. Burning coals blazed out of it. He parted the heavens and came down. Dark clouds were under his feet. He mounted the cherubim and flew. He soared on the wings of the wind. He made darkness his canopy around him, the dark rain clouds of the sky.
Okay.
So canopy there is sukkah?
Yeah, it's hard when you read it in English. You can totally miss the word you're looking for.
Interesting association with rain, though. The rain
it is.
As well.
It's a rain cloud. It's a covering. One of those covering words. There's actually two in parallel. One is a chuppah and one is a sukkah. Let me just pull it up really quick. 2 Samuel 22.
I just know, I don't know if you're looking at that, Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
Because it talked about it in Jubilees and Maccabees.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And even some of the rabbinic traditions of going around the front with the lulav, encircling the bama, I think that's listed already in Maccabees. Mm-hmm. So some of these traditions are very old, even though they're not written in our canonical text.
In the Qumran text.
Mm-hmm. Or in texts that were found at Qumran.
Right.
So verse 12 in Hebrew says, Vayashet hoshech svivotav sukkot. So he put darkness around him as sukkot. Interestingly, even in plural here, not even a sukkah. So it's some kind of shelter, or maybe it's more of an abstract noun here, sheltering. So here we have a clear reference of more of this. It's not literally a tent or a booth or a hut. It's some kind of abstract shelter made out of rain clouds or darkness or something vague and mysterious. Okay. Isaiah 1:8.
The daughter of Zion is left like a shelter in a vineyard, like a hut in a field of melons, like a city under siege.
Okay, there you have more back to the practical. It's a shelter in a vineyard of someone taking care of the vineyard, maybe during harvest. And maybe Sukkot, you know, it is a harvest festival. So the Sukkah can also be a symbol of the people working in the harvest that are celebrating for 7 days of everything that God's allowed them to do. And then again, would you mind flipping to... Oh, did you have Isaiah 4:6?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, okay, you read Isaiah 4:6.
And there will be a tabernacle for shade in the daytime from the heat, for a place of refuge, and a shelter from storm and rain.
Okay. Maybe read the verse before as well.
Then the Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion and above for assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering. And there will be a tabernacle for shade in daytime from the heat, for a place of refuge and for a shelter from storm and rain.
So this is very reminiscent of the wanderings, right? You have the cloud in the day and the fire at night. and it's some kind of protective thing. And we heard glory. There's a reference to the glory. So now this whole debate, whether it's talking about a physical shelter or the glory of God, starts to take on more life, because you see some of these texts are talking about some kind of cloud covering in God's glory. I can give you the references if you want to look at the rest on your own. More poetry. We have Psalm 31:21. Maybe we should just read that one really quick. Psalm 31:21. Does anyone want to read that for us?
Blessed be the Lord, for he has shown me his marvelous kindness in a strong city.
Okay, wait, was that verse 21? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, yeah. So in English, it's the verse before.
You shall hide them in a secret place of your presence from the plots of men. You shall keep them secretly in a pavilion from the strife of tongues.
There you go. Pavilion, that word is sukkah. Tits penem besukkah, meriv lashonot. So here, he's using it as a metaphor of God's sheltering, how he's going to protect us from other people's tongues, from being slandered and libeled, and these things that are so destructive. So again, we have a more of a sheltering of God. So the other references are in Job 27:18. Job 36:29 and Job 38:40. I'm going to skip over them for the sake of time. So you have these nice passages, a temporary shelter or a miraculous shelter if you go with the glory cloud of God.
Or both.
Or both, which is what I like. And maybe it's a false dichotomy to say one is miraculous and one is practical, because in the end, the practical safety of the people in the desert is miraculous when you think about 40 years and all the things that could go wrong. And it also kind of reminded me of the incarnation, because you have the glory of God taking on temporary dwelling with us in Jesus. That's kind of a beautiful image, a blend of a very physical, practical thing with a very kind of supernatural, mysterious thing. Last week, we also didn't really touch on how Sukkot takes on a messianic meaning. Some say this is because of the connection to the rain, and rain is more universal. People count, you know, there's 70 bulls, and that's the 70 nations. I personally couldn't count 70 bulls. I got to 65, and then the other ones didn't have numbers. But it seemed like it would be even more than 70. Anyway, so connection to rain may make it more universal. You have the concept of New Year and judgment. This whole fall season seems to be kind of judgment, which could be quite messianic and apocalyptic. We mentioned the Shnata Shemitah, the year of release every 7 years, that goes, according to Deuteronomy 31, 10 through 13, that is begun according to Sukkot. So there's always also that sense of redemption on Sukkot. So you have all these kind of a messianic thing going on as well. And my rabbit trail, what fascinated me is kind of connects those two things. The messianic idea with back with this debate on when is the first of the year. So I wanted to read quickly a passage from the Talmud and then take it home to things that relate more to us as believers in Jesus. So it's talking about, we're in Rosh Hashanah. And we're talking about all the things that happened on the different times of the year, the different holidays. And then there's justifications, which some might seem elaborate to our eyes or kind of unfounded. But the really neat thing is that the people coming up with these explanations have to really, really know every little detail of the word, to be able to play with it like that. So I wish we were all in that camp as well. So the whole debate is, when was the world created? Is it Nisan? Is it the month of Passover? Or is it Tishri, the month of Sukkot? And so you have these two different guys. One's Rabbi Eliezer, one's Rabbi Yoshua. And they both argue different ways. So Rabbi Eliezer says, well, the world was created in Tishri because of Genesis 1:11. And it says, okay. Whence do we know the world was created in Tishri? Because it says, and God said, let the earth put forth grass, herb-yielding seed, and fruit tree. That coming from Genesis 1:11. Which is the month in which the earth puts forth grass and trees are full of fruit? You must say that this is Tishri. That time was a season of rainfall, and the rain came down and the plants sprouted, as it says, and a mist went up from the earth. Now he's quoting Genesis 2, which really wasn't rain at all. It was a mist, but it is water. Watering. And there you go. So that's all to justify that the world was created when?
In the spring.
Tishri. Right around now. Sukkot. Okay. Rabbi Joshua says, whence do we know that the world was created in Nisan? In, you know, the spring. Because it says...
I'm sorry. And produce vegetation. It's not the producing, it's the harvesting.
Did you read 1:11?
1:11 is God said, let the land produce vegetation,
right.
Seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit.
Right.
So the
and he's saying,
the
when
proof
do,
of that is the harvest.
When do trees bear fruit? It's now, the harvest, yeah.
The trees here in Israel.
I'm thinking seeds, I guess, okay.
Sure, no, the other guy's about to challenge him.
Okay.
We're using the same verses. Okay, so Joshua says, we know it was created in Nisan because it says, and the earth brought forth grass, herb-yielding seed after its kind, and tree-bearing fruit. So the tree is making the fruit. That's from the next verse, verse 11, 12.
Did he create it with the fruit already on? Or he created it and then it grew in the fruit?
Great. Yeah. Actually, they
don't
really discuss that too. That's coming up.
But yeah. Yeah.
You want to hear it? Okay. Which is the month in which the earth is full of grass and trees begin to produce fruit? You must say that this is Nisan.
I would.
That time was a period when cattle, beasts, and fowls copulate with one another. Okay, he goes off a bit. As it says, the rams have mounted the sheep. And how does the other explain the text, the tree bearing fruit? So how does the first guy who thinks it's Tishri explain a tree that is bearing fruit but hasn't borne it yet? And he says, this signifies a blessing for future generations. And what does the other make of the fruit tree? The first reference, which is Genesis 1:11. And he goes with your, Lucy's observation.
Nancy.
This is to be explained in accordance with the dictum of Rabbi Joseph ben Levi. For he said, all creatures of the creation were brought into being with their full stature, their full capacities, and their full beauty. So it was created with the fruit on it, I guess, the first one.
Yeah, could be, but then Adam and Eve had to bear children.
That's right.
They didn't weren't created with the children
that was
already.
After the fall.
Well, they were created with the children inside of them. Then.
I don't believe that, but that's a theological discussion.
Anyway, I'm not saying I believe any of this.
I don't believe it.
But it's interesting how they're working little details to try to figure out when the new year was. And they're going back to creation as a basis for, if the world was created in this, this was the first month.
But the quote from Deuteronomy or wherever says, and God said this will be the first month.
Right.
And God said, so it seems like where's the
But could it have been changed? Could once, the Exodus happened in a certain point in history, right?
Uh-huh.
So what if it before that it was a different month? And now God says, now this is going to be the first
month. We're calling it in April. Okay, but it's
right.
A whole different time.
Yeah. So maybe it was originally now, and then because of the Exodus and how wonderful that was, now we're going to use that to mark our calendars. That's going to be our first month, because that's when we were redeemed. Okay,
but also the Adam is the toil of Lampus, right? He's supposed to
toil the land, yeah.
So he would take some time before the fruits grow, isn't it?
Okay, but now you're going to the second story, which is a little different. But I guess, yeah, you could use that to argue if you want. Okay, so then they go into this whole debate. How do we know that the patriarchs were born in Tishri?
Mm.
Abraham and Jacob, that is, not Isaac. When was Isaac born?
Pesach.
Pesach, good. Okay, so Abraham and Jacob, we know because all the men of Israel assembled themselves unto King Solomon at the feast in the month of Etanim, which...
Hey, that's not in the list.
Etanim is one of these old names we mentioned. And it's associated with Tishri. Because in the Bible it even gives a note. By the way, this is the seventh month, Etanim. And our Targum in Aramaic says, because it used to be, he mentions the switch in calendar. Wait, let me go back and see if I can pull that up really quick. Targum Yonah, 1 Kings 8, 2, says Tishri used to be the first month, but now it's the seventh. So, back to this whole, you know, which one was the original New Year thing. That was the Aramaic translation of Kings, which is, of course, written down later than Jesus.
Which is that reference you're using now about Rabbi Eliezer?
This one, I'm in Rosh Hashanah.
Rosh Hashanah.
I'm reading in the Talmud, which is commentary on the Mishnah. And I was reading from basically 10b, page 10b on. The debate just keeps going. So now, you know, the patriarchs are born in Tishri, and they use all kinds of fancy footwork to try to prove one way or another. Because then the other guy claims, no, the patriarchs were born in when?
Nisan,
of course. And neither of them have very strong verses to stand on. It's like little hairs they're finding here and there. But then this, listen to this. He who holds that they were born in Nisan holds that they died in Nisan. And he who holds that they were born in Tishri holds that they died in Tishri. As it says, I am 120 years old this day. Who's he quoting there?
Isaac.
120 years old this day?
That's Moses.
Moses. Deuteronomy 31:2, the day Moses died. So they say, why does he say this day? It's referring to his birthday. So that God fills out all your days, you actually die on your birthday. That goes back to the sermon, may your day of death be more blessed than your day of birth. Or in this case, if they're exactly the same. So you have this concept of people, the great patriarchs, being born and dying on the same day.
And that's okay. The day of the Jewish calendar.
Right. And yeah, on the Jewish calendar.
Yeah.
Okay, so then it goes into the debate when Isaac was born. We mentioned Passover. Because it is written, on the next festival I will return unto thee. So now he's quoting, they use the word Moed, which we know of as a festival, but it's also just an appointed time in the Bible. So the angel says to Sarah, I'm going to come back at an appointed time. And so they're saying, well, this is the next festival. So what space between festivals would fit this? If it was from Passover to Shavuot, that's too short. Shavuot to Sukkot is too short. It's 5 months. So then they say it must be Sukkot. No, it must be Sukkot to Pesach. So conceived on Sukkot, born in Pesach. And if anyone of you are really quick with math, you'll find out that that is only 6 months. But they have a tradition that she gave birth after 6 months and 2 days. So apparently some of these patriarchs were preemies, but that was also miraculous. Yeah. So, I don't know. If you have God, maybe. So, and then they have the tradition on New Year's. New Year's, again, is around just before Sukkot, before Yom Kippur. Rachel and Hannah were visited. And now they're going to connect that to all the places where it says God remembered Hannah. Because on New Year's, we're supposed to remember. So with this word connection, they connect with that. And God remembered Rachel. And then also he visits Hannah. There's a word, I think it's pakad, that it can be translated to visit or to remember. It's to take notice of, basically.
Who's Hannah?
Hannah in the Bible.
Samuel.
Who has Samuel?
Oh.
She also gets visited, of course, New Year's. And then the Lord visited Sarah. So New Year's is actually just before Sukkot. So that gives a little more time. Okay, what else happens on New Year's? Joseph goes forth from prison. How do we know this? Because it's written, blow the horn on the new moon, on the covering day for our festival. He appointed it for Joseph for a testimony when he went forth. And so this means when he goes, leaves his prison in Egypt. So again, this New Year's is back to this redemption theme. So on the New Year, the bondage of our ancestors ceased in Egypt. It is written in one place, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. In another place, I removed his shoulder from the burden. Okay, so now it's really interesting, because God actually takes away their bondage on New Year's, but they don't get redeemed till Passover. So there's a six-month thing there. In Nisan, they were delivered, as Scripture recounts. In Tishri, they will be delivered in the time to come. This is learned from the two occurrences of the word horn. Okay, so he quotes two places. So what's he saying? They were redeemed from bondage in Tishri, and so the future redemption will be in Tishri, around Sukkot time. Rabbi Joshua, our other debater, says, in Nisan they were delivered. In Nisan they will be delivered in the time to come. How do we know this? Scripture calls the Passover a night of watchings, which means a night which has been continuously watched for from the 6 days of the creation. Okay. Go up a little bit. Anyway. So, what have we learned? There's a tendency that these great redeemers are born and die on the same day. And that there's this idea of expectation, messianic expectation. When's it going to happen? Because it happened in the past in Nisan, maybe it'll happen again in Nisan. But then there's also this connection to Tishri, to Sukkot, so maybe it'll happen in Sukkot. Okay. So, then I was trying to follow up Sheila's question about when did the church actually quit celebrating Sukkot. And I didn't find much. I found one book that studied all of Sukkot and mentions kind of Christianity as a side, because he says, according to all our extant sources, it was never celebrated in the early church. But who knows? That just means it never was reported as celebrated. And so I kind of stopped on that trail right there, because I'm not an expert in early church fathers and I can't read it all in a week. But then, because I was talking about early church and celebrating holidays, I kind of went on my rabbit trail of when was Jesus born? And how do we know it, when he was born? And it's really interesting, because what do you guys know of the background of December 25th being Christmas? How do you explain that as the day? Hanukkah, but then it may have been different.
Well, it's after the winter
solstice.
Winter solstice, right? And there was an ancient holiday.
A party a couple days after, because then you know for sure that the world's not going to end.
Right, and there's a pagan myth about a sun god being born or something or other that people, skeptics, like to associate with. And those within Christianity who are against Christmas like to associate with Christmas. But actually, there's another explanation that seems to be better, and it's that they worked out when Jesus was conceived, based on what? When he died. When was Passover, the year Jesus died? And so some people based it, figured out that it would have been March 25th. So add 9 months, and what do you get? December 25th.
Oh, I never thought of that, yeah.
So half the church, well, most of the church went with that.
Oh, because they said he died the day he was born.
Yeah, the same idea, that you die when you're born, the day you're born. And this cycle of redemption kind of thing. So then the Eastern Church had a different calculation, and they said he was conceived on April 6th. So add 9 months to that, and you get January 6th, which is Christmas in the Eastern Orthodox Church. So that the current dates for the celebration of Jesus' birth actually didn't have to do with whatever other pagan holiday may or may not have been on that day, but simply a celebration based on when they calculated his conception to be,
but then
adding 9 months.
They didn't have the Christian calendar yet, right? I mean, when Jesus was born. So how did they?
Well, they, you know, they had the Caesar's calendar, Julian calendar.
Oh, then.
Yeah. Yeah, and they were much closer to the time too. So there was interest in finding out when Jesus was born, although Jesus didn't say to commemorate his birth. That was more of a pagan thing to have birthdays, which I'm not opposed to birthdays, as anyone who knows me knows.
But they're calling conception his birth?
No.
Because if they're saying he died at Passover, and he was born at Passover, but he was actually conceived at Passover,
right.
They're calling conception.
No, because then he was born on Sukkot.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Then he's born on Sukkot. And so then we're back to this debate of Passover or Sukkot? Is future redemption, is it Passover or Sukkot?
But I heard that all the...
Or is it somehow linked together with the birth and death and passion of Jesus?
December 25th seems to be good enough for the Orthodox, because they will strip you of your kosher license if you celebrate New Year's, because that's exactly a week after Jesus supposedly is born, and that means you're celebrating his circumcision.
Right.
So...
Yeah. So then it's over.
If it's good enough for Hitler, you know, that kind of thing. If you're Jewish by Hitler's standards.
So I found this great little website. I'll just scan some information here. Some guy who lives in Minnesota named John Parsons, who's, I don't know anything about him, except I found his website, and he seems to give a lot of nice detail about this debate when Jesus was born. And actually, there's two theories. You'll never guess. One argues for Sukkot, birth, Tishri. And what do you think the other one argues for?
Pesach.
Well, yeah, I'm leading you to the Pesach. For a December birth, which would mean a Pesach conception. Right, so still based on this dichotomy of Tishri or Pesach. Now they follow, this guy outlines John the Baptist. His father Zechariah was in the temple at two times during the year. According to 1 Chronicles 28, his set was the eighth order. And then if you calculate, there's 2 weeks where all the priests would serve together. That would be 10 weeks. And so starting from Nisan, that would put John the Baptist conceived in mid-Sivan, which is May or June, and then born 40 weeks later on Nisan the 15th, Passover. So actually John the Baptist is born on Passover.
So they know that.
So, well, according to this view, if you calculate according to
his father.
Zechariah's temple service, but see, he served twice in the year, so which time did the angel appear to him? So if you say the first time, then you have John the Baptist being born on Passover. And then if Jesus is 6 months later for conception, that means he was conceived in late Kislev, more around Hanukkah, and then born 40 weeks later during Sukkot. Okay. Alright, so you add, if John's birthday is the 15th, is exactly Pesach, you add 6 months, and you get the 15th day of the 7th month, which is the first day of Sukkot. So you have John born on Passover, and Jesus born on Sukkot. That's actually very beautiful.
I heard
And then you have circumstantial evidence, as he calls them. John 1:14 talks about the Word becoming flesh and making its tent or dwelling with us, which is, you know, if it were true that Jesus was born on Sukkot, that's a great little thing. You also have Jesus being the light of the world, and if you want to say he's conceived in Hanukkah, then you have the whole light festival theme.
Coming into the world. Yeah.
And he's the bread of life, I think.
Right. And also, if Jesus were born in Sukkot, it would explain people out in the field. It's not too much in the winter yet. The shepherds would still be out in the field. And in fact, I found another website that pulls out a nativity set for Sukkot, because the whole scene of Jesus being born in the stable is like a sukkah. And they're in Bethlehem, one of the feasts, right? Because there are three times a year you make pilgrimage to where you're from, to Jerusalem. And so the family would be, presumably, one of those feasts would be when Jesus was born. So we're on our way to Jerusalem.
That's why there was no room in the inn.
So maybe Sukkot. And so maybe, yeah, there's no room in the inn.
We'll also Pesach.
Build your sukkah or find the stable and make that a sukkah. Okay, so
well,
that
actually, Hanukkah is basically Sukkot. If you read the story, you know, in Maccabees, the 8 days of Hanukkah is actually the 8 days of Sukkot.
All right, but then it was celebrated different.
Just it got delayed because things were impure.
And for the background, where's our first reference of Hanukkah?
In
anywhere. Yeah. No, the celebration of the Feast of Lights.
John?
Outside the Book of Maccabees.
In John.
John. Yeah. Yeah. So even though it's a Jewish holiday, it's actually first recorded in the New Testament, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to end that whole thing, for the argument for the late December birth, had John's father Zacharias going on the second temple service day. And so that would put Jesus being conceived in Nisan, near Passover, and born 40 weeks later during late December. So then you have, you know, church history that assigned that. What else do you have?
Are they really trying to be accurate, or is it just...
I think some people are. I think the early church was trying to be accurate as well, when they took an interest into what time Jesus was actually born.
And it goes back that far, early church, Christmas, December?
Well, they were the ones that came up with this conception date based on his passion.
His death.
His death. Uh-huh. Being over Passover, and what, in his year, when exactly, what was the day of Passover? And that's where you have the Western tradition.
The early church would have known.
When Jesus was conceived? Not necessarily. When he was born?
Well, it wasn't that long. I mean, he was only died.
Right, but
30.
People didn't really record.
They didn't?
Not the Jews.
Oh.
I mean, in many
Mary
cultures today.
Right,
Mary should remember, right. So certainly there should have been some verbal tradition.
Well, they wouldn't know from the mother. The mother could have told him. But maybe they didn't care.
They didn't care at first, exactly.
It didn't matter.
Because no one celebrated it,
birthdays,
because that was considered more pagan.
Yeah.
It was only, but they were still interested, because incarnation is such a big thing, you're still interested when it happened.
Yeah.
So apparently when they looked into it, wasn't in the first few generations, but still closer than we are.
But it's not recorded in the Gospels, is the bottom line.
Right, it's not recorded what time of the year.
It just tells a story.
Definitely not.
So why doesn't it tell a story? The Gospels are our earliest witness.
We do, because we're meant to remember his death. His day of death and resurrection is bigger than his day of birth. Or, as we see in this study, maybe they're connected. Maybe his conception and his death were in the same time of year. We do know that he died around Passover. That's clear in the Gospels. So our future redemption, is Jesus going to come back on Passover or Sukkot?
Sukkot.
to cook? I don't know. I think you could argue either way.
It's about joy. I mean,
you've got to come. Yeah. Joy. Yeah.
But the great thing is that there's two options, so you can never be totally sure. And he did say, anyway, it would be bad if you thought it was for sure Sukkot. If one Sukkot goes by, you think, oh, I have another year, you know? But if it could be any time, you're not sure, then you're always ready.
And all this parable about that, and so much of the Christian tradition is about surprises and breaking rules.
Yeah.
And so much of this tradition is to read in the word for the law and the truth and the everything revealed. Everything is there. We need to find it. All the rabbis are studying it.
Well, yeah, there's both, though. It's there and it's not there.
Because there's the mystical.
Yeah, there's still interpretation, and you don't know for sure. I think it's the kind of thing, like, looking back, it all fits together and makes sense. Like, once you see Jesus, you look back and it makes sense. But if you just read Isaiah's prophecies, you wouldn't necessarily think directly of Jesus. So it's like looking back, when Jesus comes back again, it all makes sense. But right now, it's very, you can't really predict it. The pattern becomes obvious kind of more at the end than at the beginning. So don't be bashful about celebrating Christmas on the 25th of December. If you want to celebrate Jesus' birth, or if you want to celebrate Hanukkah for his conception, you can do that too. Or Sukkot, you can celebrate Jesus' birth.
Or it's a combination of Hanukkah and Sukkot.
Or each of the holidays, just in case, to celebrate his birth. And that way you have this constant reminder of redemption throughout the year. Okay, so the service is starting downstairs. Shabbat shalom.